I'm Randy. I'm an alcoholic.
Randy.
And this has been a real pleasure up till now. I really enjoyed listening to Renee last night. I really appreciated her forthrightness and the sincerity that she told her story. And I really liked AJ this morning. He told my husband's story about being a workaholic and being a great father, but maybe not being so present when I wanted help. And it meant a lot to me because he also told the other half of my story about losing his wife, which I lost my husband. And he just told details about the grieving process that, you know, you always think you're unique until you listen to somebody share. I want to thank Milton because he was really, really kind, and I think really it was self-serving, to be honest with you, but he called me a lot to make sure I was going to be coming up here. I want to thank my very dear friends, Jim and Gloria. We have been friends for many, many years, and those two are very, very special to their AA and Al-Anon communities. They have been very generous with their time and service, and a lot of people love them, as I do. I think I'm going to start with a joke. And I'm going to tell you now, this joke is Milton's fault. Because I told this joke last night, and I said, you know, I'm not allowed to tell this joke anymore because it's not PC. That's politically correct for those of you. And you know, he has that gravel whiskey I drank too much a little while ago voice. I think you ought to tell that joke. I said, okay, but if I tell it, I'm blaming it on you. That's all right, you tell that joke. So here we go. There was a man and a wife, and they lived together in a nice little house, and they both had jobs, and everything was swinging. And one day, the wife came home because she thought she'd forgotten to turn off the coffee pot. And she heard a funny sound in the back of the house. She went back there, and her husband was in bed with another woman. Well, there was just a tiny dust-up about it, and he swore that the first time that had ever happened, it would never happen again. So she let him off the hook, and she was a good Al-Anon. And she let him off the hook, and a little while later, maybe a month, 2 months later, she forgot her purse. She really did. And she went home, and she thought, nah. But she went back, and by God, he was in bed with another woman. Well, this time, he was on the sofa for a long time. But she let him back in the big bed, and things went along. And about a week later, she's thinking, you know, this guy's got a history. I don't really trust this man. I'm just going to go check. So she left work in the middle of the day, and she went home, and she went right back to the bedroom, and by God, there he was. He was in bed with another woman. And she just pulled back the covers, and he was in bed with a midget. And he said to her, I'm tapering off. My first sponsor used to tell that joke, and then he'd say, but he was in trouble anyhow. And then he'd say, and so will you be if you try to taper off. You won't make it. I was born in Iowa, and I went to school in Boston, where I met my husband. I come to this program when I was 28. My sobriety date is December 20th, 1970. And I came to this program with a lot more baggage than I thought I did. And part of that baggage was that I have a family history of alcoholism, severe depression, and suicide. A lot of my cousins just stick a gun in their mouth and pull a trigger. And I'm very mindful of that family history medically and emotionally and spiritually, because I think it's important for me to do so. And I've passed that information on to my children. I have three grown children who have children of their own. That's so cool. They're suffering now. None of them have exhibited the signs of alcoholism to this time. So it is possible to bring that genetic history and still you're not doomed, I think, to have alcoholic children. My mother was an alcoholic, and more of her in a minute. But I also brought, and I didn't realize that till I came here and I listened to what you guys had to say. You said that alcoholism was a disease and that it was three parts in nature, that it had a physical component, a mental or emotional component, and a spiritual component. I had my first, well, I was raised in a household that was very nice, and I was taught, I think, in an amazingly generous, easy-does-it way. I got no attitude from either of my parents, who had suffered a lot of alcoholism in their own homes as children. I got no attitude from them at all, and they taught me how to drink like a lady, and what red wines were for, and what Chardonnays were for, and what martinis were for. And interestingly, and see, this isn't my picture of an alcoholic, as a young girl going to parties, I never drank that I mean, I might have gotten a drink, but I never, you know, just didn't do that. I wasn't exhibiting the signs of physical alcoholism until the last years of my drinking, but I have those. Mentally, I had a tremendous resentment against my mother. She was, let's just say she was an interesting person, and very hard on people. She did amazing things, though. You know, I still don't get this. She'd call me into her bedroom in the morning, and she'd say, go get me a glass of milk. Now, you could smell the garlic and the booze. Why did we drink booze and eat garlic? Why is that such a go-together? But the whole room stinks. And I'm, 7 or 8 years old. I go get her a glass. How can you drink a glass of milk? Go throw up like everybody else, you know. So she would sip on this milk, and she would set up the camera and the screen, and she would roll this camera. This is figuratively now. She'd roll this story of last night. And she'd roll the film, and you'd pretty much get the right version the first time we ran the film. And then another glass of milk, and we'd edit it. Long story short, it started out that she might not have been too nice to that lady at the party last night. By the third version, that lady was the Wicked Witch of the West, and she was only defending herself. I learned to run this movie. Bill Wilson calls this purposeful forgetting. Takes me 3.5 days to purposely forget something I don't want to remember. So I learned that from my mother, but I carried this tremendous confusion and a lot of resentment. And one of the pieces of my resentment that came back to haunt me was, I said, well, I know one thing. I don't say that anymore, because every time I say I know one thing, that's exactly the thing I don't know. Anyway, I know one thing. I'm not going to be like my mother. I don't know how many of us, in the silence of the night when we're 14, say, I'm not going to be like my dad. I'm not going to be like my mother. I don't care what else I do. Well, spiritually, I received a wonderful education in terms of conscience, morals, ethics, and I'm very grateful for that because I think it saved my life. And the reason I think it saved my life is because I didn't get drunk with ease, ever, ever. I had to justify my drinking all the time. And 10 years of justifying can wear you down. So I came with the full package when I got here. And I drank at my father's funeral. I got drunk at my father's funeral. You know, it's those things that you do. I remember running up the stairs into the belfry of the little church. I was shattered. I was like 3 weeks from delivering his first grandson, and he died from a surgical mistake. And I was just shattered, and I got knee-walking drunk. That must be a pretty picture, you know, a woman about to deliver, walking around just drunk and pie-eyed at her own father's funeral. You know, moments that make you proud, you know? I was the girl at the party that when the band stopped playing, I would go up and play the drums. I was the guy that would go back to the bar where the guys were and try to outdo them in dirty jokes. I mean, I just made my husband so proud. And I was the woman that would slip a coffee cup full of gin into my sink. Doesn't everybody do this? I didn't want anybody to know I was drinking. Gin, you know, you can't get enough juniper berry. I mean, it's got antioxidants and all kinds of... Anyway, I used to put my coffee cup full of gin in the sink, and I'd sip on it. And I never did that with ease. But I had this round. I didn't drink every day. I didn't get drunk every time I drank. But every time I drank, I got in trouble. And I got in trouble in my own house. My house was neat as a pin. My little girl, she looked like a little Oriental child because I pulled her hair back so hard. My floors, you could eat off my floors. Not that you would want to, but you could if you had to. And I developed this round, and this is where I knew, but I did not know. I had a habitual behavior that I was completely unaware of. Every day was a new day. Every day was a new day. Usually started at about 4 a.m, and I was sick as a dog. Nobody come up after the meeting and tell me they never got sick and threw up. I've heard that before, and I don't want to hear it anymore. And I would go into the bathroom, and I would read American Standard. It was written right across. That was really the only reading I did. I had 3 babies, and I was busy. So American Standard. And I'd throw up, and I'd go back to bed, and my eyes would be open, and cars would go by on the street, and the headlights would go like this. Well, I have to get up and go be sick again. I couldn't get my eyes to stop the headlights from going like this. So the next morning, I was feeling too good. And my husband always, every single time, said this thing, that second really big resentment, well, I think I'll go to work today. I hated that. I hated that. It was completely unromantic to start with, and he knew I didn't feel well, but he never said a word. He never said a word. Well, I think I'll go to work today, and I'd say, well, Dibs, you know, I'm not feeling too good today. Oh, that's too bad, he'd say. I'm sorry to hear that. He'd go out looking like $1 million a time, you know, his little briefcase and everything, and I was looking like Cinderella after, and the kids wanted breakfast. And, yeah, thank you. I just, you know. And so He'd say, I tell you what, I think I'll just kind of go on into work, and if you don't feel well by noon, why don't you give me a call? Well, see, he knew me, and he knew that by 10:30, I would be just fine. I hated this man. So at 10:30, by golly, I was standing at the stove or wherever saying something I was to say 1,000 times. Well, I'll never do that again. I'm done. That's it. I'm all done. By 2 o'clock, I'd be saying, well, it wasn't that bad. See what I'm doing? I'm making the same movie my mother made. It wasn't that bad last night. It wasn't that bad. I didn't get that drunk. Just because I spilled that brandy in the television and broke it, not a big deal. So by about 3:30, and you know, this is true. If you have to do two shifts, and in my opinion, every mother does two shifts. You do the day shift and you do the night shift. You start your whole damn day over again at 4 o'clock. Kids are coming home, husband's coming home, everybody wants supper, let's do homework, let's have baths. Where's the energy gonna come from? And I learned later, actually, that alcohol releases glycogen, which is a kind of sugar, into your bloodstream, and you do get energy. That's why we feel so good at first. So I would say to myself, well, I'll just have one coffee cup full of gin. Now, here's the thing. Nobody came to my house. I was the only one I was hiding my gin from. But I never lost it. Dibs would come home, I call him Dibs. Dibs would come home, and I'd suggest, let's have a drink. Now it's Wednesday, see, this guy has been, he's coming from the hospital, he's been on the freeway or whatever for an hour. He'd like to say hi to his kids, but it's 6:30 or 7 o'clock, because he doesn't get home from the hospital till 6 or 7 o'clock, and the kids are in bed. Oh, I forgot to tell you, if I'm going to drink, I'm not going to be like my mother. Kids not going to see me drink. Now, that means to me that my children have to go to bed around 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. No matter what time that man came home, he was never going to see those kids. And they would, when they got a little older, they would say, Mommy, why are all the children playing outside? Why do we have to go to bed? And I'd say, oh, they're mothers. Bad, bad, bad mothers. Not good mothers at all. You children, I never loved my children so much as when I closed the door. And I would go downstairs and get my gin. He'd come home. I had the Joy of Cooking book. It was given to me as a wedding gift. And in the Joy of Cooking book, I don't know if it's still there, I was always very careful about my weight. And so I drank 1,000 calories a day. Because everybody knows you can lose weight if you only use 1,000 calories a day. Now, if you go to the Joy of Cooking book, you learn very quickly that gin has only got 70 calories an ounce. I mean, I'm the thinking man's alcoholic, okay? So I parcel myself out, and I have my gin. Also in the Joy of Cooking book are certain recipes where you have to use 1/4 cup of red wine. So 1/4 cup would go into the dinner, and the rest of the bottle would go into Randy. And I'd say brightly, probably very cross-eyed, let's have a drink, Div. I don't have a drink. So he would make a drink, and he did something that annoyed me. I was jealous, but it annoyed me. He'd make us drinks, we'd go in the living room, we'd sit in the chair, and I go, oh, thank you, conk. And he would sip his drink. Why do you bother? He didn't finish his drink. So he would just, see, there are little things you do as a man and a wife that you do, and you don't know you're doing it. Not a word was passed. He just slid that glass over. He knew. Conk. So we'd have dinner, and we'd go upstairs and watch TV, go to bed, day's over. Not quite. I'd say, hey, would you like some ice cream? Yeah, that sounds good. So I go down to the kitchen and rattle around in the kitchen, and I go over to the liquor cabinet and just have a little pull from the Rittenhouse rye bottle. Liked Rittenhouse rye. One time, and I'm not making this up, we'd both been to a James Bond movie, and I went into the liquor cabinet, and right before I opened the door, I realized there was a hair pasted across the liquor cabinet door. And it was suspiciously dark and Italian, just like my husband's hair. So I took that hair off the liquor cabinet door. I opened it. I got my rye, and I put the hair back on the liquor cabinet door. I think it takes a very twisted spirit to put a hair on a liquor cabinet door. I'm not so sure about the person who goes looking for the hair on the liquor cabinet. That was my life. Now, it didn't happen every day, but it was an unendurable round of a predictable way of living that was too awful, because I had to justify it all the time. One day, I was going to commit suicide again. I forgot my suicide attempts. I remember, you know how it says, don't tear this tag off the pillow or you know, the FBI will invade your home? Well, it says on the aspirin bottle, don't take more than two of these. So I took four aspirin. And I lay on the sofa and I waited for death to come. And it didn't. When my husband was defending his thesis, I thought I'd just wander into the kitchen, turn the gas stove on, and lay my head on the rack in there. I probably still have little grill lines on my face. I didn't die that night either. This is funny and terribly tragic. It's terribly, what a call for help these things are. And I didn't know that, and I don't know if he knew that or not. He was busy. Anyhow, this one day, December 19th, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. Someone asked me, are you going to tell us why you came here? I will. It was my birthday. It was December 20th. His birthday. He bought me a birthday present. I mean, I really had things worked out pretty good. The martinis were in place, and the present was a set of exquisite jade grapes. They were beautiful, green jade. They were beautiful. And they were all wrapped up. He wrapped the package himself. Now, please understand, he's living with a drunk. He's watching, and I'm sure, and I know, he told me. He was very worried about his children. I'd humiliated him in public. And he gave me this present that we could not afford, but I had seen them and I loved them. And he pushed that present over to my side of the table with as much love as a person can have in his eyes. And I opened the package. I thought to myself, oh, those are nice. I looked and my glass was empty, and I said, that's nice, Dibs, my glass is empty. Doesn't sound like much. And so that was the whole ball game to me. Where did he get that love? Why did he give me that present? What the hell was wrong with me? That the only thing that mattered was that my glass was empty. I was so horrified by that was my bottom, that I was down in my basement the next morning, and I was going to kill myself. I met someone later who tried it, malathion. I was going to drink a bottle of malathion. I was. Now, this gets a little woo-woo, and I don't really mean it to, but for some reason, and it's odd, when I commit suicide, I kind of different. I put a little spin on the ball, and so I took the laundry out of the washer and put it in the dryer. And so then I picked up the bottle of malathion, and this idea came to my head. I know now that this idea was the gift of my God. And the idea was, call AA. AA was not in my consciousness. I had seen a movie called The Days of Wine and Roses. You got to be old to remember that movie, but it was a wonderful, heartbreaking movie. And my grandfather had been in AA, I'm not going to go through the whole family, but I don't know why that day I answered the call. I haven't got the faintest idea. So I'm living in Boston now. I don't know if you guys have been to Boston, but they're very special up there. And so I called AA. Now, I'm surprised I did this because although I had never heard of AA or been there, I knew all about it. I know all about everything. Just ask me. And if I don't know, I'll make it up and I'll convince you that I know. And what I knew about AA was that they had a big situation room. And they had a big, you know, like those World War II maps where it shows you where the ships are? Well, they had this big map on the wall, and when you called from your house, your number lit up on that wall. They called it Alcoholics Anonymous, but your number was flashing. So why I called them, I really don't know. I was getting a little strange. And this man, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, and he was eating a piece of pizza. Now see, a hangover and a piece of pizza, not my idea of the way to fly. So already, AA is different. This guy has something I want, and that is a good stomach. That was the first thing you guys said. How do you feel about having a nice stomach? So I called up and he went, AA, and can I help you? And I said, yes. You have a little trouble with booze, sweetheart? He said, no, it's nothing like that at all. If you could just send me some material, I'm sure you have some printed material, maybe in an envelope without my name and address on it, I would... Gotta have your number, sweetheart. That's how they talk up there. And he was so damn well. Gotta have your number, sweetheart, he said. Okay, here's my number. Gonna have someone call you, honey. Get right to you. Okay. So the phone rings. Now here's another mirror. I answer the damn... I used to hide from the mailman. You know what's interesting? I did. I'd go under this little shelf on my sun porch when the mailman would... This is a grown woman with three children. I'm hiding under the shelf in the... Found out he was a drunk, by the way. The mailman. So the phone rings, and it's Martha. Martha. That's how they say Martha there. And she said... I got your name and number. I'll meet you in the square. And I'll give you a meeting list. And so there you and you know, okay, I'll meet you in the square. I don't meet anybody in the square. So I go down in the square and it's all beautiful, and it's Christmassy, and everybody's got presents and there's light bulbs everywhere. And Martha pops out of this car and she has curlers that are pink that are about this big. And she said, hi, I'm Martha from Alcoholics Anonymous, all over Lexington, Massachusetts. And I'm thinking, and Martha says, we're going to go to a meeting. I don't want to go to a meeting. You meet me at the Star Market, and we'll go to a meeting. I go to a meeting, and as we're driving to the meeting, she says, by the way, kid, I forgot to tell you, I'm an epileptic, and if I should happen to have a fit on the way to the meeting... And I'm going, I want to go home. And you know where she took me? Metropolitan State Hospital, of course. Lovely place. Men banging their heads on the green walls and the sofas, you know, burnt out. Oh, it's nice, nice. And it's cool to walk into a state mental hospital because they just close those gates behind you like you're never getting out of here, ever. You know, the funny thing is, I knew I was headed for Metropolitan State Hospital. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew it. Never been in any kind of institution like that in my life, and I recognized it immediately. So strange. So I go to a meeting, and Martha says, "You're going to need a sponsor. See that guy over there?" And that guy was about the size of Jimmy down here. And he was 500 pounds of loud. And I walked over to him. I'm 28 years old, and I said, "I'm supposed to be your pigeon." And we called them pigeons in those days. The reason why, ask me after. It's not too clean, but it's pretty good. Anyway, I'm thinking, I don't want to be somebody's pigeon. I don't want to be somebody's damn bird. So I go up and I say, "Will you be my sponsor?" "I guess so. I have to ask my sponsor." So he goes over and his sponsor goes. See, now there's no men in AA, there's no women in AA when I joined in Boston. I'm sure there were. I never saw one, not for 2.5 years. And I kept saying to Ray, "Where are the women? Where are the women?" And he said, "Well, we don't seem to appeal to the women very much. Maybe if you'd just sit in the chair long enough and shut up, we'll attract another one." Well, you know, about 2.5 years later, Kathy came in and sat beside me, and she stayed. And I hated her, because I had all these guys to myself, and I really liked it. Anyway, I put up with Kathy, and we became really good friends. So Ray and I were, he sponsored me until I left Boston and came down here. He took me to something that changed the direction of my sobriety a lot. He took me to something called an AWOL program. It was a program where you did the 12 steps. I was talking to someone this afternoon. We figured it out. And you spent 1 week on the first step, 5 weeks on the fifth step, 12 weeks on the 12th step. And you did. You spent 12 weeks going to hospitals, jails, institutions, telling, you know, trying to help. So I guess it was a year, every week. And the most salient feature of that experience for me was you got assigned someone to hear your fifth step, and I got Father Henry. I don't know why I got Father. Father Henry was a drunk now, but he was sober, but he was a priest. And so I took my little, you know, garbage bag of stuff, my fifth step, to Father Henry, and I read and read and read. I mean, I just creamed myself. I raked myself over the coals. It was gorgeous. I was so proud. I just knew he would go, "Oh my God, that's the best fifth step I've ever heard." He didn't say that. He said, "That was very nice. I'm going to go and make a cup of tea for us. And then I'll come back and I'll hear the other half of your fifth step." And what would that be, I'm thinking? I shot my wad, honey. I got nothing else. What do I do now? So I said, "Father, I'm not entirely certain what you're expecting me to read to you now." "Oh, your assets, your talents, and your virtues," he said. "Nah, don't do that. No. See, you have to understand, I praise myself to, you know, I don't care what you think about it," he said. "You can't say the seventh prayer until you've done that. The seventh prayer says, 'My Lord, I now offer you all of me, the good and the bad. Now, how can I give my higher power what is good for his service if I don't know what it is?'" Never thought of it that way. So, being a good little parochial school girl, I was mad. I hated Father Henry. Dumb jerk. He didn't know anything. Oh, and he said, don't come back for 6 months. I want you to really, you know, think this over for six. I went back to Father Henry. But, you know, it really changed the way, I think it was the first time I ever got balance, perspective, distance from myself, and recognized that I was not created by me. And taking a look at the good that I present, the gifts that he's given me, the talents, the virtues, these are the things. I mean, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life stamping out what is wrong. I used to do that, by the way. I used to wake up and I go, I'm not going to get mad today. Guess how well that went? Well, I sort of see that I would be stuck not doing things, not expressing my defects of character. And he gave me something so much better. Go and do that. I really think it made a big difference. About that time, my marriage was going south. By that I mean, house was still clean, lawn was still mowed, bills were paid, old Dibs was going out the door to work. Randy was sober, but it was like two ships in the night. Nothing happening between us anymore. Oh, we fixed the garage and we fixed the disposal, but there's no love there. We're having an habitual relationship, if that's possible. So he's going to England. He flew all over all the time. He was always gone when something happened. I noticed that. Anyway, he was off to England, and this morning he came down and he ran back upstairs. He forgot something, and his coat is flying all over, and his taxi is there. And, you know, he's one of these kind of guys. And as he ran out the door, I thought to myself, I hope the damn plane crashes, and I hope the insurance is paid up. And he opens the door, and I go, oh, he's come back to say goodbye. He said, got my damn coat caught in the door. Slam, he's gone. I think that was the first time that I reached a second bottom. We don't talk about a second bottom in AA very much anymore. You know, you can be not drinking for a long time, but there comes a day, and don't be surprised, there comes a day when that's not enough. It's just not enough. It doesn't get it. You can't get all excited because you didn't have a drink today. Because two-thirds of you, if you're like me, are still very sick. So, I had truly tried to improve my marriage. I really had. And I didn't, you know, dance naked in front of the television. I don't think he would have cared. He'd get out of the way. I'm watching my game. But I really tried. And when he left, I started talking in a new way to my higher power. I was really talking to my higher power. And here's what I said. I don't know what to do now. I don't know what to do now. I've let go, I've held on, I've told the truth, I've been considerate, I've been selfless, I have tried, and we're nowhere. I wandered around that whole weekend, churning, really, and I remember the kids were on the third floor watching TV. I was down in the living room, and for some reason I got down on my knees and I said, God, I really don't know what to do. And the phone rang. I'm not making this up. The phone rang. And it was Don from London. It was 3:30 in the morning. And he said, you know, Rand, you have really changed. And old Dibs hasn't changed at all. I've written you a letter, and in that letter, I've asked you to marry me again. And when I come home, if you consent, I'd like to get married again. I'd like to put our marriage on a new footing. Well, I hung up the phone, and I went, hot diggity dog, that's just what I'm looking for. What'll I wear? Who will I invite? How many guests will I have? And this voice goes, excuse me. And I go, what do you want? Remember now, I have done in a nanosecond what every single thing you tried to do in 5 years did not accomplish. I want you to turn this over. I want you to turn this over. I want you to let go. I don't care what you wear. I don't care who's there. And what's more, I don't care if he completely forgets that he ever did this. I want you to let it go. And I did. I really did. And he didn't forget. And there's nothing worse than an ex-Italian Catholic. But he went to a priest. He found a priest. And in the Catholic Church, there is a renewal of marriage vows service. So our wedding day went like this. We didn't have any guests at our wedding. Well, that's not true. We took the kids out of school. The kids were sitting where those folks are right now. And Amy said to Jesse, I thought they were married. Starting who knows what rumors at school. We went to McDonald's for our wedding feast. We went to Arnold's Arboretum, which is like a botanical gardens, for our honeymoon. I don't remember to this day what I wore, and I don't really care. What I know is that I couldn't have planned a lovelier, more dedicated event. My husband started going to Al-Anon. He started a men's Al-Anon group in Birmingham. It was good. It was good. But I think that's the first time. It took me 5 years to let go of something Randy really wanted. You know, Dr. Silkworth says that we can want something so bad we think we need it. We cannot separate what we want from what we need. And I learned that day that what I really needed was God carrying the ball instead of me. We went, after a little while, to live in Portugal. Now, of course, I know, this is me. I know how to speak Portuguese. I know all about Portugal. I've never been to Portugal. I have three babies, and we're off to Portugal. He's going to do a sabbatical year in Portugal. And there's no AA there. There's no AA there. So I call central office in New York, and I get the name of this, oh my God, deaf as a codfish, Englishman named Reggie. So I call Reggie, and Reggie's favorite line was, AA is growing and growing in England. Do you have AA in America too? And that made me so mad, and I explained every week, we started the damn thing. We'd drive into Lisbon because Father Terence gave us a little room to have our AA meeting in. We wanted to, you know, we were advertising in the English newspaper and everything. And we would go up to this little, we had to kind of, it was the combat zone of Lisbon, and then you go up into this little room. And this particular priory, their manufacturer was what you guys would call white lightning. That's what they made at that monastery. And they called it Bagacinho. Well, Dibs and Reggie and I'd shout all the way into Lisbon. I'd be mad before I even get to them. You know, if you just shout at a deaf person long enough, you can get really, really angry. So I tiptoe through the stuff in the street, and I get upstairs, and Father Terence always brought two root beer jugs full of Bagacinho to the AA meeting for Don and himself. And he would light it with a match, and it would burn merrily, and then they'd blow the flame out, and they'd just sit there and get pie-eyed while Reggie and I would have an AA meeting. Father Terence got sent down. He got sent home. That was a, there was an Argentinian architect, a croupier from Goa, a German idiot. It was a different kind of AA meeting, just let me tell you. I started speaking at English high schools. That's odd, you know, you're walking down the streets of Cascais and someone goes, "Hey, Randy!" I'm going, "I don't know anybody here." And it's like three high school kids that I spoke to the high school. It was kind of cool, felt good. But I hope they didn't say anything more in the street. I came home and I was like, I'm like a POW must feel. When you go for a year and you're all alone, you learn that you really need people. You know, Bill Wilson says in the big book that alcoholics have two cravings. One of those cravings is alcohol. But the other craving, have you noticed it in the big book? Fellowship. Our need for one another is at the level of a craving. Now, for a bunch of loners, that's hard news. That's hard. I don't cry in front of anybody. I don't really talk about what happened when I was a kid to nobody. I told one person about my childhood, and that was my husband. I told nobody. When I got back from Portugal, once again, Randy gets a new insight. I think I need these people. And I began to go early, stay late, and to this day, I do what I started doing. I call three people in the program every single day of my life. I try to call one person who's new, one person who's got the same time as I do, and one person who's got more time than I do. Now, that's getting a little tougher. Those last two are getting a little tougher. But I do have a girlfriend that I've known for 1,000 years, and I call her, well, every day. And that has been a practice of mine because I need to practice fellowship. Isn't that sad? I need to practice fellowship. The interesting thing is that once you tap into a loner, sober alcoholic, you got a friend for life, because we all have this craving. And when we find it in one another, something unbelievable happens. And we open up to each other, we feel safe, and we talk. And when we cry, we leave each other alone, but we sit right with them. We don't get nosy, but we don't go away. It's a wonderful thing that happens, but it took me a long time to give in. That's another bottom for me, giving in to becoming known, truly known. Just when we were going to retire and the kids were finally gone and college was almost paid for, and we were going to get gorgeous before we hit the rocking chairs, just gorgeous. So we started going to the hospital gym, whatever they call it, wellness center. I hate that, wellness center. So we went to the wellness center, and one night, Dibs came over, and he said, "I don't feel so good." I said, "No, what's the matter?" And he said, I don't know, I don't feel so good." So the little girl that was in the desk came over and she said, "What's the matter, Dr. DeBoer? What's the matter with you?" And he said, "I don't know, I don't feel so good." And she said, "You don't look so good." She called an ambulance. I mean, we were going out of town the next day. You know, life. Moving right along, people. Get into the ER, and this doctor, like, slams me up against a wall and says, "I'm going to tell you something right now." Of course, they all know him. "I'm going to tell you something right now. Your husband is having a massive heart attack. I don't want you to fall apart. I want you to get yourself together, and then I'll let you go in there." "Okay, yes, sir." I go in there, and he does his heart attack thing and stays in the hospital, and the balloons and the clowns and the fruit and all that junk, and we go home. So, okay, we'll replan the trip. 2 weeks later, he comes down the stairs. I'm on the phone. He goes, I don't feel so good. He's having another heart attack. Well, they decide, you know, let's take a deeper look. Long story short, if you're even close to the medical profession, they'll just tell it like it is. So we're sitting in front of the screen, and Charlie says to Don, man, you got a bad case of scleroderma. It's an autoimmune disease. It doesn't really matter. But you got a bad case that you got about 5 years. Bang. Scleroderma is a very nasty, ugly disease. Just take my word for it. So we spent 5 years in a sort of a horrible, magical place. You know, if you start to see all these, I mean, the guy that brought us oxygen and the home health nurse, and I mean, these are the saints you don't read about in the newspaper. They're just awesome people. I remember they wheeled Dibs off for something, and I remember standing at the window, looking out the window, and I was going to cry, and I remember this woman. She had to work there. She just turned me around. She just buried my head in her bosom. She let me cry. She said, are you done, darling? And I said, yes, ma'am. And she left. I don't know who she was. Anyway, through all of that, AA's, they brought me my birthday. My belly button birthday is the 24th of December. And they would bring me my present at 11 p.m. on the 24th of December. They'd ring my bell and bring me a birthday present. They did that. They contained me. They held me. But they didn't crowd me. You know, I don't like to be crowded. I don't think any of us do. He passed away. And that morning, in the kitchen, I thought to myself, I got to go to an AA meeting. And I remember going to my home group, my AA meeting, and some guy came up and said, I heard your husband died. What are you doing here? And I said to him, where else would I go? And I just sat there. I held my daughter's hand here, because they took me. No one would let me drive. My daughter's hand here and my son-in-law's hand here, and I just cried and cried through that whole meeting. I didn't make any noise. I just cried. And they just let me be. They let me be there. This is what we do for one another. Where do you go? Who do you pay for that? I don't know. I know that I owe. And I want to give back so much, because I've been given so much. I have one last revelation. You know, it took me 34 years in AA to go to Al-Anon. And I needed to go there, because 50% of my story was missing. I'm speaking as an AA now. 50% of my story was uninvestigated, unexamined, and unexplained. I came from a family whose culture was cover it up. Yes, there's an elephant living in our house, but it's not really there. You didn't really see that elephant. There's a whole way of life that goes with that. There's a whole way of life that goes with that. And as a little kid, you eat that, you drink that, you breathe that, and you incorporate it. And you live it, and you don't even know it. I went to Al-Anon. I was terrified. 34 years of sobriety, terrified to go to Al-Anon, because, oh, this is me. I know all about Al-Anon. I've never been there before. But I know what they do there. You know what they do there. They talk about us, right? They talk about us. What else is there to talk about? going to Al-Anon for 5 years. They've never talked about, never. What's worse, from an alcoholic perspective, I must report, I've heard these people say painful, painful things that have happened to them as a result of the alcoholism in their families. I've never heard one mean remark about an alcoholic in Al-Anon. Never. Now, I knew all about Al-Anon, but I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting that. I made the decision to go there like I went to AA in the first place. I'm not a recovering alcoholic with 34 years. I'm flying blind here, and I need help because I don't understand my childhood. I don't understand it. I don't understand why I do certain things and defend myself and wall up in certain ways and won't communicate. I don't understand it. I got a sponsor there also, and I won't, because this is an AA talk, I won't go much further with that. But it was, again, it explained the missing 50% of who I am. I worked so hard at AA, and yet there was something missing that needed attention. And I guess what I'm reporting is, you can just be the queen of cool, like I am, and be dumb as a stick, okay? And once again, my perspective has been altered, and I understand my own alcoholism much, much better. With a more amplified feeling of acceptance about my choices and my decisions and what my old idea. You know, it says you got to let go of those old ideas. You know, we don't always know what our old ideas are. How can you let go of something you don't think you're hanging on to? So I begin again now to examine and to let go of old ideas. And I'm very, very grateful. I think it's a little sad it took me a quarter of a century plus, but, you know, better late than never. I have a joyful life. I never thought without Dibs. Dibs was the arm waving, let's go to, you know, Zimbabwe or something. Let's put on the music and let's dance in the kitchen. He was the energy ball of which we all circulated around. And when it was like the sun went black when he was gone. And I remember that first year deciding to feel what I felt, not to block it off, not to wall it up. And I told my daughter, okay, that's it. I'm going to save a fortune on mascara right now because I'm not even going to bother putting it on. You know, when women cry, they keep going like this. Huh? Well, I thought, I'm not going to spend my days going like this. To hell with it. I'm not going to put on the damn mascara. And grief's a funny thing. It'll come and tap you on the shoulder when you least expect it. You can be in a store, at a movie, you can hear a fragment of a song, you can see a shape walking down the street, and you go, oh, and you start crying. So I didn't wear mascara for a whole year. And in that year, I wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. What do I want to be when I grow up? What do I want to be? And what I wanted to do more than anything, I lived in Charleston. It's very hot, very pretty, nice place to visit, but geez, it's hot. Charleston, South Carolina. And I got a chance to, in my emotional heart, come home to Birmingham. And it's amazing to come back to a place that you spent time because, you know, I hook up with Jimmy and Gloria again and just tons, little Mary, and tons of people that knew me in my life. And And so I don't feel like a stranger in a strange world at all. I do sleep with a man. His name is Friday, and he weighs 12 pounds, and he's a poodle. Friday and I are pretty tight, so that's it. Bed's full. Well, except for Rosie. Rosie sleeps on one side, and Friday sleeps on the other side. I still don't listen to music. I still can't listen to music. I know AJ said it took him, 14 months? He's way ahead of me on that one. I still can't listen to music. But I have learned, and this is my final thing to say, I've learned that if this is a threefold disease, it's got a threefold solution. And what that means is I have a biological family, a physical family. I have a mental, intellectual family. People who are interested in the same books and movies, and I have a spiritual family. Now, I'm an only child, so the idea which God gave me that in fact I truly, and this is what St. Francis was all about, you know, we use St. Francis' prayer in our 11th step, this was his whole thing. We are, you know, our genetic material is like so tight. We're related to the ducks and the bees and the ants and certainly related to one another. We really are each other's brothers and sisters. We really are each other's sons and daughters. And now, see, somebody said, aren't you going to get married again? I said, hell no, I don't want to marry some 70-year-old man. I want a young guy. So God sent me young guys. I have these sons. And these boys are wonderful. They look out for me, and we go to museums, and they call me and ask me how I am, and they come and move plants. And when their wife has a baby, like the last time, Shay called me and said, okay, the baby's coming, you better come. It makes me cry because his mother was there. And his mother-in-law was there. And they both were joyful to see me. That's very intimate, don't you think? To hold a baby that's 1 minute old. I have these wonderful sons. I have wonderful daughters. Wonderful daughters. I have uncles. I have brothers. Chuckles. Chuck. I call Chuck Chuckles because he never laughs. So I call him Chuck. Chuckles is my brother. Chuckles is my brother. Gene is my brother. I have a family so enormous that it would be physically impossible to have this big of a family. How wonderful is that? It's been such a gift. And coming and meeting you here, I got two confessions, and then I'll sit down and shut up. One is, if you have 38 years of sobriety and someone says, how long have you been sober? You like duck and cover. Because if you say how long you've been sober, there's like this invisible thing that comes down and they go, well, she's all well. She doesn't know anything about my problems. Not true. Talk to me. So I did this thing for the last 20 years. Well, what time did you get up this morning? Oh, you got up earlier than I did, so you've got more sobriety. I am now officially admitting I'm an alcoholic and a self-admitted old-timer. That's it. And the reason I tell you that, and this is the first time, I just know it. The reason I tell you that is because that's the reason I'm here, because I'm a self-admitted. I wanted to come here and listen and harvest people who've been in sober for a while. Well, so how's it going for you? What's going on? What do you think about stuff? How's it working? I had a wonderful conversation this afternoon, was it? Or yesterday or sometime. And I met that wonderful little girl over there with the hair. I love that little girl down there. And I talked to you guys and I harvested your experience and your strength and your hope. And you lit my fire, you really did. And I'm so, so glad to have been asked to come here. It's been a pleasure. I really look forward to hearing our speaker tomorrow morning as well. And I want to thank you so much for letting me come.